Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Top Docs and the CEO. This is an hour of medical information featuring commentary by some of the top doctors in their specializations. And I'm Dick Kovatsky, CEO of Net Medical, a telemedicine company with a number of specialists, primary care physicians, and technology used by the healthcare industry. This morning, Terry Belanger, CEO of TechNet, is with us. And on our program today, we'll be talking about new ways to get primary healthcare services for your family. We've got two medical industry executives, both of them happen to be from Atlanta. They'll be talking to us today about concierge medicine. Editor-in-Chief Michael Tetro from Concierge Medicine Today will tell us what's happening with this relatively new type of service that first came into existence in about 1996. Kind of an interesting history. And also Adrian Davis, CEO of My Ideal Doctor. He'll be talking about how companies are looking at providing healthcare via telemedicine from your smartphones to your laptops. And Dr. Stan Snowden, one of our regulars, stops in to talk about a new anticoagulant drug, and it's called Eliquist from Bristol-Myers Squibb. Interesting topics on our Top Docs and the CEO this morning. Concierge medicine is a term some of our listeners might not be familiar with. It's a relatively new term in the last 10 to 15 years to show up in our lexicon, maybe back in 1996. What is it? Well, it's a special relationship between a patient and a primary care physician in which the patient pays an annual fee, or sometimes it's called a retainer. In exchange for the retainer, the doctors provide enhanced care, including principally a commitment to limit patient loads to ensure adequate time and availability for each patient. And we have with us today, to learn more about it, Michael Tetro, the editor-in-chief of a publication, and a relatively new publication in the last several years, named Concierge Medicine Today, quite appropriately. Terry, you're with us this morning, so what do you think we should learn about concierge medicine?
Well, Dick, I can tell you that I am a patient who uses concierge medicine, and I am very, very pleased with it, and, you know, can't say enough positive about it. But I think that it would be interesting to ask Michael to tell us a little bit about the history of concierge medicine and where it came from.
Sure. Thanks, and thank you for having me on. Concierge medicine is a relatively new brand name for a healthcare delivery model that is actually very much affordable for the masses, that despite what we might hear in the media and other places on television, those types of things, 62% of the concierge medicine doctors out there who are active in this type of delivery model charge less than $135 a month. And I know we all have probably cable bills or cell phone bills that are much higher than that, but when it started out in the mid-90s, it was relatively new. And anything new to any particular market or business space is going to be more expensive when it first arises because it's new and it's in demand. And then as concierge medicine became a little bit more known among the healthcare and physician audiences, there became more doctors out there to serve and treat these patients and offer membership type of programs on a monthly, quarterly, or annual retainer basis. The terms that have been used to describe concierge care are membership medicine, boutique healthcare, retainer medicine. We also have heard terms such as direct primary care, which is a different model of medicine, but in relatively a cousin of concierge medicine, but act differently in its delivery and in its payment structure. Right now, there are about 12,000 physicians across the United States who practice this form of healthcare delivery to their patients. And it's interesting to find that there's actually a lot of consumers, or i.e. prospective patients, who are searching out these types of doctors because, as we all know, the medical industry is one of the very last business industries in the United States that's finally telling their customers how much things cost. I mean, for so long, we go to the hospital or we go to the emergency room or we go to our doctor's office and we give them this plastic card like we do a credit card and just assume everything's going to be covered. And then 3 weeks later, we get an EOB or some type of bill and we don't know who it's from or whether it's from, maybe it's from our doctor's office, and we're wondering, well, why I thought I had insurance. I thought that was going to cover everything. So with the expensive and escalating cost of healthcare nowadays, concierge medicine has become a real transparent and affordable alternative, despite what we might hear in the media over the last several years.
I was looking at this and saying, when I first heard about the term concierge medicine, I was thinking of the concierges that you see in a hotel, and generally it's not going to be Motel 6 that you're going to see a concierge in.
Right.
And so you would think that it would be a pretty expensive process, a program maybe only for the top executives and folks that don't need to worry about money. And it sounds like from what Michael is saying is that that's not true.
That's correct. I mean, we did a survey and a polling analysis through our publications, and we found that really only 1% to 3% of the overall marketplace in concierge medicine services the elite executives, the high-level CEOs, and the celebrities. 1% to 3%. So that means that about 97% to 98% of the consuming patient population utilizing concierge care and its other forms, its other business models, cash only, direct pay, is middle class. Anywhere from age 30 to age 65, it's very, very affordable despite what we've heard and believed in the past.
Well, of course, if you watch Royal Pains on TV, there, you know, he's serving the Hamptons, so I think that probably kind of gives an indication of expense, too. I have a very good friend of mine who is a retired military and is eligible for medical coverage under the VA, but has signed up for concierge medicine because it's the only way, you know, he can reliably get medical service. So I agree with you. The people I'm seeing that are all involved with this type of medicine, our friends of mine, they're all middle class, middle income people.
Well, and to think about it in a, you know, a pictorial type of way, and I always like to use analogies, is this is Andy Griffith style medicine, so to speak. I mean, we, you know, the doctor in Mayberry, pretty sure he didn't make Opie, well, I need you to come in for an office visit.
Yeah.
Aunt B probably wasn't. Is he participating in Medicare? So it's very old-fashioned, but it's in a modern day delivery model.
We are, both Dick and I, are heavily involved in telemedicine and the use of the technology in the delivery of medical care. And we see that within the realm of concierge medicine, there's probably a significant application of this type of technology to help patients. And in fact, I've experienced that with my doctor myself, you know, not having to go into the office, but being able to communicate electronically with him and save myself having to drag myself out of bed and get to his office.
Well, and absolutely, telemedicine is part of the daily tools used by these types of doctors. And I mean, there's all sorts of modern applications for all types of healthcare technology nowadays. And these doctors, you know, typically small practices, they're 1 to 3 employees, but they're trying to communicate to their patients. It's really all about the relationship that the physician has with their patient. It's like having a doctor in the family is what I've said for years. And the most common type of phone call that these types of doctors get is prescription renewals. We've actually found in our polling and surveys and interviews with doctors that these doctors are able to, in some cases, wean their heavily prescribed patients off of medication almost completely and increase prescription compliance because the doctor is able to follow up with the patient 3 days, a week, or 3 weeks later and say, hey, how's that prescription working for you? Or when was the last time your doctor sat down with you in the office? He said, you know, hold on, I'll be right back. He comes back 1 minute later and says, this is the list of all of the local grocery store pharmacy $4 prescription drugs. Or here's the list of the large box chain free prescriptions that we might be able to take advantage of. Let's see if some of these will work for you. I know that I don't think I've had a doctor have that type of consultation with me where he's looking at all of the ways that he can help save me money. And a lot of these doctors are doing that type of thing. Another way they're utilizing telemedicine is they're getting a lot of calls from their patients on just simple cold and flu and backache type of things. I know that might sound petty, but usually that requires an office visit and for us to schedule an appointment and to take a half a day off work because we've got a migraine or we've got severe back pain that is chronic and we think we've got a pinched nerve. Because the doctor has a relationship with their patients that's much closer, they're able to say, have you tried cold compress or a hot compress? And let me call you back in an hour after you've tried the hot compress, and we'll see how things are going. And I'm not a physician myself. I'm an editor. There are obviously medical things that I don't know and very well aware of, but those are the types of things that how doctors are utilizing telemedicine, as well as they've got a patient who goes hiking in Montana, and the doctor's back in Virginia. He takes a picture of his sprained ankle or a bad cut, and you know, he's able to send it back to the doctor and over the iPhone or Skype, you know, visits and say, look, I've got this. The doctor's able to say, okay, I see that you're on the trail. you're not close to any kind of medical facility. Here's how we should bandage it up. Let's call me when you get back to the hotel, or call me when you get back to the emergency room. A lot of these doctors can prevent emergency room and hospitalization. MDVIP came out a couple of years ago with some hospitalization data that was very relevant to how these types of practices are decreasing the amount of hospitalizations that patients under the care of these types of affordable doctors are having. And it was just an amazing study. And I don't have the stats in front of me, but if you just go to our website, you can probably find that.
Telemedicine is growing quickly in healthcare, very, very definitely. And we saw just this week, speaking of surveys, that 80% of people with smartphones or tablets would prefer to talk to a doctor in that manner. Just like someone was saying a couple of weeks ago on the program, that you buy travel through iPhones and iPads and Android devices. How about ordering pizzas and food and so forth? Now they're starting to think about doing this with medicine.
Well, it certainly makes a lot of sense. If you think about a regular office visit, and again, not to a concierge doctor necessarily, but if you think about a regular office visit today, we schedule you a week or two out, you finally do get in there, you're sitting in the waiting room with a dozen different sick people coughing and carrying other things around. Oftentimes, I think it's more dangerous to go into the doctor's office than it is to take any type of chance on doing it electronically. So, and again, you know, in my experience, I had woken up one morning and coming off a bad cold, it had gone into pleurisy, and instead of having to call it doctor up and try and convince him to let me come in or go to an urgent care center, you know, just to get an antibiotic, I was able to contact my concierge doctor. We talked it through. He called in the antibiotic. I was on the antibiotic and on the mend within a half hour.
Wow.
To me, that's where medicine needs to be. And then, of course, with our problems in rural areas, if we can't begin to use technology for this type of primary care service, I don't know how we're ever going to deliver adequate service.
Well, we're talking with Michael Tetro, editor-in-chief of Concierge Medicine Today at www.conciergemedicinetoday.com. And we'll be back with Michael Tetro after this break.
Over 30 years ago, Dr. David Molina began a journey. He believed every person should be able to afford quality health care. Today, his family follows in his footsteps with Molina Healthcare. It's a promise to be there with you, like family, as you journey through life, giving you great doctors nearby and a 24-hour nurse advice line. For more information, call 877-751-5702. Molina Healthcare, your extended family.
We're talking with Michael Tetro, editor-in-chief of Concierge Medicine Today, on the whole subject of concierge medicine. So, Michael, let me ask you a question. We talked about the fact that it's not all that expensive to do concierge medicine. But how would you find a doctor who specializes in this area?
Sure, that's a great question. There are a number of resources out there. We have a doctor directory that covers all of the country, parts of Canada, strangely enough. But there's a physician directory that they can just search in their state. And if they're not able to find a doctor, then we usually encourage them to give us a call, and we can search our internal database to see if there's somebody that's in that area that might be relatively new, or maybe has an alternative model or some sort of membership program inside of their practice. There are a number of doctors out there that are great doctors. The rural areas are, unfortunately, a little bit less underserved than some of the metro areas, just simply because of population and density.
So that does make it difficult. You know, this really makes so much sense to me. What are the barriers to more doctors practicing this way?
Well, I think that there are enough physicians who are curious about these types of healthcare delivery models, but becoming an employee of a hospital, becoming a hospital physician, or having your practice being purchased by a hospital or selling off your practice is definitely an appealing financial alternative for a lot of doctors who are approaching retirement and saying, you know, I've been on the hamster wheel seeing 45 patients a day at 7 minutes to 15 minutes apiece, and I'm just not happy with my career anymore. And I'm kind of ready to get out. And I had an interesting conversation with some hospital doctors there a couple of weeks ago at one of the large hospitals here in Atlanta, and they definitely know all about concierge medicine and say, that's what I'm going to do pretty soon here. There are a lot of questions, startup and business-related questions, and messaging and communication questions. Do I still participate in Medicare as a physician? Do I accept Medicare patients? Do I participate in some health plan payer insurance plans versus some other PPO plans? how do I evaluate all that stuff? I'm a busy doctor every single day seeing patients. I don't know if I have the energy to do this. And, you know, spouse support, not in the way that we think of spousal support, but having the support of your spouse in moving forward with this, as well as the support of your staff, is also another barrier of entry. If your spouse doesn't understand this type of business model, a lot of consultants out there who are helping doctors engage and move them into these business models say that you shouldn't move into this just yet until your spouse is on board. And we all know, happy wife, happy life.
I understand that one entirely. It would seem to me that this would be a better alternative lifestyle than, you know, having to, as you said, deal with 45 patients a day, you know, having the overhead of running a large office and with all of the pressures of the complicated medical records and paper, converting paper records to electronic, having to have a large billing staff and all of that.
Yeah. Is the practice different from a primary care physician as far as concierge medicine?
Well, in answer to that question, I would say that a lot of these practices, you might think that they're very heavily staffed or they've got glossy paint and really super nice furniture, and that might be the case in a small amount of practices. But the majority of these practices have 1 to 3, maybe 4 employees, and so they're very small businesses. When you think of concierge medicine, that might not be something that you consider. You really do have the attention there, and a lot of the appeal of concierge care and the other alternatives like direct primary care and cash-only type of medicine is that you don't have the administrative overhead and burden of having somebody who's just dedicated every single day to answering phones, another person's dedicated to verifying insurance, another person is just dedicated to, you know, making sure that we got paid for particular claims over the last couple of weeks. All of that overhead shrinks when you move into these types of delivery models.
You mentioned Medicare before, and so I have an interest in knowing, between Medicare and the Affordable Care Act, what impact does that have on these doctors?
Well, there's always been that Medicare reimbursement cuts are going to be kicked down the road and kicked down the road, and they never seem to appear, but we eventually, someday, they're going to. And a lot of doctors, whether it's through Medicare or their insurance contracts that they're participating in on the hamster wheel of healthcare and these traditional primary care and family practice models, they're seeing these reimbursements get ratcheted down and ratcheted down, and they're seeing more and more patients come in. And that's why we've always got to schedule an office visit. We've always got to come in to have, you know, a certain amount of time with the nurse versus a certain amount of time with the doctor. But a lot of doctors, it's a personal decision for them as to whether or not they're going to participate in Medicare. It's not that they're not going to see any Medicare patients. They will see Medicare. But doctors who practice in these delivery models are very careful, and they work with attorneys and they work with consultants to make sure that they're in accordance with all state guidelines, state regulations, health care, Medicare laws, to make sure that they are not providing any service that is covered by Medicare or by an insurance company. They are not in the business of insurance, and that is something that a lot of people need to be very clear about, is these doctors do not provide any form of health insurance. They provide essentially access to your doctor on a regular basis. These are access-based value-added services, and it might sound like, well, there you go, there's the catch. But really, when a doctor in Texas recently said, I'm a family physician and I can treat, you know, on average, in one individual's, I can treat 88% of one individual's care per year. So that means only 12% of the rest of their care is going to be, if possible, is going to need to go to a specialist. So when you have that relationship with your doctor on a daily basis, whether you're Medicare aged, you're, you know, just approaching Medicare, if you're participating in Medicare, then, and that doctor is still participating in Medicare, he will provide you with the services under the agreement that you have with him, under the membership or the retainer fee. But then if he provides a Medicare-related service that is covered by Medicare, he will then bill Medicare. So I hope that answers your question somewhat.
Yeah, and what about the ACA? Is the ACA, you know, what impact does that have on concierge medicine?
Well, the ACA has actually been, a lot of doctors have waited for the shoe to drop before they've considered moving into this type of medical delivery model. And the ACA actually, in relation to its cousin of concierge medicine, is called direct primary care, which is slightly different in its business structure and delivery model to a patient. They have direct primary care doctors or typically cash-only doctors, but they also, you know, have, instead of a retainer fee or an annual fee, they typically charge by the month, and they have more patients that they're seeing, where typical concierge practices see about 300 to 600 patients. Direct primary care, its cousin, sees about 750 to about 1,000 patients, and usually the fees are just less than $100. So they're very affordable. We see the average fee for direct primary care as being, you know, $50 to $100. And going back to the ACA itself has actually recognized direct primary care and acknowledged it as a viable non-insurance medical offering inside of the ACA language. And so the rub is where, you know, people don't understand that these types of healthcare membership medicine programs are not insurance. These are just value-added services that give you a relationship with your physician, because a physician, as we said, he's seeing 45 patients a day. He's so busy. And when you ask a lot of these doctors, you know, why did you go into this? It's not because they're going to get paid more, because we've done
right.
the analysis of physician salaries. They're not concierge doctors. They're not making a whole lot more than what they're currently making. It's relatively small. And we all think, well, I feel sorry for doctors, but they've got a lot of medical debt. They've got a lot of, I mean, a medical device to put into a doctor's office is a lot more expensive than buying a couch for us as regular people. But they've got some of these medical devices cost several thousands of dollars. And they put four, five, seven of these things in their offices just to be able to do x-rays and to do urinalysis and all these types of testings. But one of the things that's not talked about is this really interesting component is the cash savings that these doctors are offering to their patients, where we have a high deductible health plan or an HSA, or we have health insurance, and the doctor says, well, I need to order an MRI. We need to get a CAT scan. Well, you can go to the clinic or to the hospital down the road that's recommended that you go to, or for a lab test, you know, the lab core or whatever, and say, I need to get a test, and then you pay your insurance a certain amount for a deductible, towards your deductible or some sort of copay. Then a doctor who's a concierge or direct primary care doctor can tell you, I went to the local lab down the street, and I can get you a CAT scan for $150. That's my cash rate. Would that be appetizing to you? Well, yeah, that would be a lot appetizing to me, because otherwise it's $450 to go file it through my insurance.
Right.
Towards my deductible. And, you know, those types of cash discounts is, like, getting back to what we very first talked about, is this is an industry that's just now starting to tell their customers how much things cost, and the customers are really reacting very positively to it.
Let me ask you a question about concierge medicine today. When you started the program on the web as a magazine, what was its purpose, and what is its purpose today, for example, if it's different than when you first started it?
Yeah, our purpose is the same then as it is now, and that is to be a single source of truth about an industry that is maybe misunderstood or mischaracterized, and just to let people know that there's definitely some bad headlines out there, fewer than there used to be. But I think now that people are coming and seeing what kind of news is coming out of this industry, whether it's hospitalization, different types of doctors. There was a doctor that would just hit the wire this morning from Iowa about his, you know, delivery model and what he's doing that's unique in his practice. There's another one that came out from Maryland and Bethesda that was really unique. You know, the seeing that there's specialty care inside of concierge medicine, and anti-aging is a very popular form of concierge care. And I think just our purpose has always been to be a single source of truth in reporting the news and the truth and the legal headlines, the legal op-eds, the white papers that different people put out, putting out physician opinions about their good experience with it, their bad experience with it, and also highlighting from a patient perspective, encouraging consumers out there to give concierge medicine and direct primary care a second look, because it's not what you might think it is.
Well, I want you to know that I've just bookmarked your webpage because, you know, as I'm scanning through this, it's, you know, very, very informative and very interesting.
Well, thank you.
Who would have thought that Dr. Howard Marin, back in 1996 in Seattle, had a little practice called MD Squared, and he came up with the concept, he says. He said he's never come up with the term concierge medicine. He knows what a concierge is, but to describe what I do, I prefer to call it highly attentive medicine. And
yes,
I think that's well put.
Absolutely.
Michael, thanks very much for joining us today on Top Docs and the CEO. We enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it, guys.
You come back.
Hello, I'm Dr. Chanel Helgeson, a board-certified psychiatrist in Colorado. I do telemedicine for Net Medical.
When telemedicine is needed, get the top doctors from Net Medical. Great healthcare for patients everywhere. Google Net Medical.
Well, back with us again on Top Docs and the CEO is Dr. Stan Snowden. Dr. Snowden is an expert on all of the new types of medicine that is hitting the market. And what do we have today, Dr. Snowden?
Today, we're going to talk about a relatively new drug. There have been some commercials on it. It's called Eliquis.
Eliquist. What's it supposed to do?
The generic name for this is apixaban. So you may hear it referred to by both names. It's an anticoagulant, so it thins the blood. And similarly to warfarin, we know warfarin thins the blood, but Eliquis only hits one specific clotting factor. It's called factor 10. It's a little more direct than warfarin is. Who are the people who should be taking the medication? Right now, the FDA indications are for patients with non-valvular atrial fibrillation, which is a type of heart rhythm that patients may have, or to prevent a clot in patients who have had a hip replacement or a knee replacement. Who should it not be prescribed for? There are some people, mainly people who have allergies to the drug, should not take it, or if they are actively bleeding, which makes sense because this drug is an anticoagulant, so it promotes bleeding. So if someone's already bleeding, you don't want to give them something that will make it worse. So what to expect from this medication? Essentially, why is your physician prescribing this for you? What are you hoping to get out of it? So this medication has been shown in a couple of studies to prevent clotting, especially in patients with atrial fibrillation. Non-valvular atrial fibrillation has been shown to reduce strokes more so than warfarin, patients on just warfarin. The expectation is when you're put on this drug, especially for non-valvular atrial fibrillation, that you will not develop a stroke, or the likelihood of you developing a stroke is much less than it would be otherwise. Some things to think about: a lot of people on non-valvular atrial fibrillation are on warfarin, and we know warfarin's been around for a long time. We have a lot of experience with it. But some differences between this, warfarin, we know patients have to go and get blood tests, so they have to have what's known as their INR, or international normalized ratio, check to make sure that the drug's working, but also that they're not being too anticoagulated, as well as we have to really watch out for what patients eat, as that could affect it. And there's a lot of dosing adjustments that are made with our Eliquis. Does not have any routine blood monitoring. There's no big interactions with food per se, so you don't have to really watch what you're eating necessarily and make dose adjustments. But one of the big things that I just want to throw out there is we know warfarin does have an antidote. It's vitamin K. So if someone has too high of an INR or they're bleeding, we can give them vitamin K and that can help reverse that. With Eliquis, there is no reversal agent. So if someone's profusely bleeding, we don't have something that we can just automatically give them to help stop the bleeding like we do with warfarin. Some side effects to watch out for: because this is an anticoagulant, the big side effect is bleeding. However, it does tend in clinical trials to have less bleeding than warfarin. But that is something to keep an eye out for, as well as allergic reactions. So some people may be allergic to this drug. Some things to look out for there: if they have any swelling of the lips, the throat, if they notice any wheezing or itching, those may be some things to watch out for in terms of having an allergic reaction. Another thing to think about is, how is it dosed? This is one medication that is taking twice a day. So typically, especially for non-valvular atrial fibrillation, it's 5 milligrams twice a day. The dose may be decreased to 2.5 milligrams twice a day for patients who have, maybe they have bad kidney function, so serum creatinine at least 1.5. If they're low weight, so less than equal to 60 kilograms, which is 132 pounds, as well as elderly patients, if they're 80 years of age or older, will decrease the dose. For hip and knee replacements, the dose is the same. So for a hip replacement, it's 2.5 milligrams twice a day, and that's short term, for 35 days. And knee replacement, it's the same dose, but it's only for 12 days. So most of the patients who are going to be put on this drug are going to be more for non-valvular atrial fibrillation, and that'll be more long-term. But initially, you know, we want to check for liver and kidney function because that may affect the initial dose that someone's put on. Also, signs of bleedings. A patient may say, well, I've had some bleeding in my urine or stool, or they have excessive bleeding from like the ears or nose, as well as bruises that either progress or don't go away, or things that may indicate that they have maybe some bleeding, they're low on volume, such as increase in fatigue or dizziness, things like that. So those are things that patients have to keep an eye out for, and clinicians will keep an eye out for as well. So the cost of the medication can be somewhat prohibitory. 1 month supply is going to be 60 tablets. It's going to be about $350 a month, depending on where you go. And that's just the cash price. This is without insurance.
Sure.
Bristol-Myers Squibb does have some patient assistance programs for patients who have health insurance and those who don't have health insurance.
Similar to what we had with Belvique a few weeks ago when we were talking about that.
Right. So, for example, there is a patient assistance program, and there are cards for patients who have health insurance to where there's a copay of just $10 a month, which is fantastic.
Absolutely.
I have a couple patients on it, and they can't afford the copay through their health insurance, but because they have the health insurance, I've given them the $10 copay card, and they've done beautifully on it. But just some other things to consider, there is a black box warning for this drug to not just stop taking the drug without talking to your physician, healthcare provider.
I had never heard of a black box warning. Had you, Terry?
No. So in some of the studies, there had been an increased risk in stroke, and this is in the more the non-valvular AFib literature, that once Eliquis was stopped, there was a small signal, a small increase in stroke. So the FDA went ahead and said, no, don't just stop Eliquis without talking to your provider. And there should be another anticoagulant on board if you're just going to stop it. So there is a black box warning out for that. There are some medications that do interact with Eliquis. The list can be pretty long just because this drug goes through one of the main liver systems that a lot of other drugs do. So you just want to talk to your healthcare provider first just to make sure there are no drugs that interact. And one thing to consider, there haven't been any studies with this, but grapefruit juice has a potential, it's a theoretical potential, to increase the blood levels of Eliquis. There haven't been any studies on it, and so this is all theoretical.
When you say increase the blood levels, mm-hmm. what do you mean specifically?
So one thing that grapefruit juice we know can do is there are some, it's a specific enzyme called cytochrome P450-3A4, and that metabolizes the Eliquis. And sometime, we know grapefruit juice can inhibit those enzymes in the intestine and a smaller amount in the liver. And so the Eliquis isn't broken down as readily.
And so consequently, the blood thinning capability is not as effective? Is that?
It could be a little too effective.
Too effective, okay. Okay.
But it's theoretical. There is a website that does look at drug interactions with grapefruit juice and medications. It's called www.druginteractioncenter.org. And it helps put into perspective what literature is out there in terms of, is this a major interaction or minor?
Okay, we've been talking to Dr. Stan Snowden about the drug Eliquis. Found out some interesting new things for people who are suffering from AFib. And so, Dr. Snowden, thanks for stopping in today, and we'll see you again in a couple of weeks.
This is Dr. Jerry Satterley from New Orleans, and I have been a board-certified radiologist with Net Medical for 8 years.
When telemedicine is needed, get the top doctors from Net Medical. Great healthcare for patients everywhere. Google Net Medical.
On this morning's program, we have Adrian Davis, the CEO of My Ideal Doctor, with us today out of Atlanta, Georgia. Adrian, good morning.
Good morning, Dick. How are you?
I am doing well. And Adrian is a veteran in the medical industry, having worked with Baxter Healthcare and Philips Healthcare. Having worked in the medical industry and noticing the constant rise of healthcare costs and limited access, Adrian founded My Ideal Doctor. My Ideal Doctor is a telehealth company that provides 24/7 access to U.S. licensed physicians who can consult, diagnose, or prescribe medications if needed by phone or on web video for episodic care. Their goal is provide instant access to emergency care or primary care physicians for common and acute conditions. Adrian, we've been hearing a lot about this type of emerging business that is going on where you have a virtual doctor or an online doctor. What does this all mean?
I'll tell you, we started the company mainly because we saw where healthcare was going in the industry, where access was becoming a major problem. Obviously, costs were going out of control. With My Ideal Doctor, essentially what we do, we provide emergency medicine physicians, family practice physicians for our members 24/7 by phone or web video, who can consult, diagnose, and prescribe medications if needed. We do this mainly through employer groups, health systems, and health plans. Our main goal is to redirect all the non-emergent ER and urgent care use to more appropriate modes of care, such as telehealth. And so we're trying to reduce those costs, get people in sooner, quicker, and have a quality consultation by doing that. We handle episodic care, so your sinus infections, your cold and flu, your urinary tract infections, nausea, gout, common and acute conditions that really you do not need to be going to an ER or an urgent care for, and it's simply a phone call or video chat away.
A few weeks ago on the program, we discussed the fact that there was going to be a shortage of primary care physicians. I think the number was around 91,000, and it's not going to be next year, but it's going to be certainly within a few years by 2018, which is not that far away. Is this going to help in terms of being able to provide patients across the United States with health care?
Absolutely, and this is where the market's going. You know, when you refer to the shortage of physicians, there's a couple different reasons for that. One, you've got the physicians in the baby boomer population that are just nearing retirement age. You've got more people coming on the insurance rolls through PPACA and other means. And so we do not currently have enough physicians to take care of that excess supply in the marketplace. And so you're going to see a shift towards telehealth, where for your basic primary needs, members, patients can go online and get a consult done very quickly. It's very accessible, and you're going to see this more and more. We think it's going to be the future of healthcare. There's many different segments of telehealth. What we provide is primary care telehealth.
We hear the word telehealth and telemedicine. Is there a difference between the two in your mind?
Not really. Telemedicine is more of a, I think, older terminology. When you're really talking about teleradiology, you know, there's a lot of aspects within telehealth. You can include remote monitoring within telehealth. You can include telestroke, telecardiology. So there's a lot of different segments within our marketplace. You know, again, we handle your primary care, but there's some great companies out there that are handling teleradiology, telestroke, telepathology, and telecardiology. So you're going to see this kind of move into the healthcare system in a lot of different departments within that health system. You're going to see it more and more with insurance and health plans, trying to redirect and reduce those costs. And then obviously employer plans. They're wanting to find new ways, innovative ways to get their employees the care they need when they need it at a better cost. And so obviously self-funded groups are putting it more into their benefits package and supplying it for their employees.
I suppose with the advent of smartphones and iPads and Android devices, these type of devices are going to accelerate that need where the lines cross, where it's more convenient to do healthcare through a telemedicine or a telehealth avenue as opposed to going to a doctor's office.
Absolutely. And that's one reason we got into the industry. You know, we were looking around, kind of seeing where healthcare was going. Obviously, PPACA was on everyone's minds. You've got technology, whether it's an iPhone or it's an Android. You've got different technologies coming out in the home. You know, you read about Nest and, you know, those guys buying Dropcam. And you're going to see the Internet of Things not only be in your pocket, but also in your home. And so you're going to see healthcare really taking that shift through technology, through mobile devices, in a lot of different means, whether it's telehealth with us or whether it's remote monitoring for a older population, diabetic monitoring, whether it's readmissions. You know, right now there's a problem in our readmissions where we just don't have that necessary 30-day monitoring when someone gets out of the hospital. And so you're going to see, I think, more monitoring in that area to keep that patient healthy and at home versus having an episode where they need to come back into the ER and get readmitted. So you're going to see it not only, like I said, you know, it first started, I mean, really, if you think about it, Dick, telehealth has been around for 100 years, as long as the telephone's been around. And so now with the advancement of technology, with the advancement of video, HIPAA-compliant solutions, you're going to see that that spread into a lot of different areas. And the main goal, again, is to provide quality care, quick access, and to reduce cost. And really, you know, I think one day you're going to see the doctor just pop up on your TV screen at home and do a video chat, whether that has to do with a sinus infection or it has to do with mental health, or, you know, just remote monitoring for congestive heart failure.
It's kind of interesting. We are actually doing this interview and it's being recorded for playback on the live show on Saturday morning, but we're doing it with a video conference type of mechanism where you're in Atlanta and I'm in Albuquerque, and we have the ability to have a very, very nice connection. I can see you, you can see me, and it's going to have that kind of effect, and more people are going to be learning about it. As a matter of fact, just in the last few days, I had noted in the stock market, GoPro, which is one of these new camera companies that are offering very, very low-cost cameras, had a 31% increase in their stock valuation because more and more people are beginning to look at this kind of product for use within a variety of different ways.
No doubt. And it's exciting. And it's not just here in the U.S. You know, when you look across the landscape, the global landscape, you know, essentially everyone has the same problem we have. They have difficulty accessing healthcare. One of the main reasons is, you know, the majority of your physicians live in urban areas, whereas the majority of your citizens do not. You know, it's hard to, if you're in a rural area, it's hard to access a top-notch specialist at a top-tier health system. And so we're going to need this type of technology to really get a handle on healthcare globally. You know, when you think about other countries out there that do not necessarily have the transportation infrastructure we have, where it's definitely hard to get to that health system or that provider. And you look at the increase of mobile phones. I mean, it's amazing when you look at the increase of smartphones in developing worlds, how many citizens have a smartphone.
Absolutely.
And so that's going to really change, I think, not only financially for them, but, you know, in the healthcare industry, it's going to really change the way the world looks at everything we do. And so it's very exciting because, you know, we're going to be able to provide true instant health care no matter where you are on this planet one day.
Let's talk about Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. We haven't done much with that on the program, but it seems to me that there's more and more people looking at the advantages and disadvantages of the effect that the Health Care Act has been providing. What do you think this means for my ideal doctor?
I think it's fantastic. You know, when you look at PPACA and what it's trying to do, it's trying to provide health care for those that are uninsured currently. I think, obviously, as more people are insured, that just helps us more and more. But it also You know, with that being said, you've got to look at it on the other end, like we mentioned earlier, that there's a shortage of physicians. So we're going to have to really look at it and gauge how do we get them in the system. You know, just because you've got a piece of paper that says you have insurance doesn't mean you're going to be able to see a physician tomorrow. When you look at the average wait times across different cities in the U.S., they're very high. I mean, they're really high. If you're one of those lucky few that can just text your doctor and talk to them, that's great. But the majority of us cannot do that. And so, you know, we see PPACA as a good thing for us. We see it, you know, really being on our side with the two factors that we try to do the best, and that's increase access and reducing costs. You're going to have more folks driven towards telehealth. You've got more and more high deductible health plans, first dollar out. And so now the consumer is finally being a consumer in the healthcare world. You know, before it was, hey, I've got a $25 copay, I've got a $35 copay, and, you know, they really don't know where that other money ends up. But it, you know, a physician visit or an ER visit costs more than $35. It costs more than $50 copay. And so you're really seeing consumers be consumers and watch their money. And so I think that helps tremendously when they have a sinus infection. It's a first dollar out plan. It's high deductible. You know, they're going to think twice before they go to an urgent care or an ER for a simple condition. And, you know, if they can pick up their phone and do a video chat or give us a call for a very low price, that's what they're going to do. So I think overall, it's going to be very helpful. You know, I think a lot of people are still trying to work out the kinks in the system. And so, but it's going to be fun.
Okay, so I've been looking at Obamacare, and I am in the healthcare business, and I still sometimes don't even understand the implications. I still don't understand the implications of how someone would be able to utilize your service if they have a bronze plan. They have a deductible of $12,500, and they're also paying $400 a month for the health care on the bronze plan for the Affordable Care Act. How does this work? I'm really confused about that.
Well, in that scenario, if it's first dollar out and they do not have any copays, you know, instead of going to a physician where it could be $80, $100, $120 for a visit, they can simply call us and have that visit for $38, $40, $45. And so it's really cost savings in the system. Again, you know, when you look at the bronze plans and you look at, I think 52% of the plans that were picked on the exchange were either bronze or silver. So you're looking that, you know, it's telling us society is looking at it going, hey, I've got to have a high deductible. I want to pay a low premium and let me figure out how I access my health care.
We're talking to Adrian Davis of My Ideal Doctor, and we'll be right back with Adrian.
I am Tanzid Sham. I'm a pediatric neurologist and a sports concussion specialist. I do telemedicine consults for Net Medical.
When telemedicine is needed, get the top doctors from Net Medical. Great healthcare for patients everywhere. Google Net Medical.
On Top Docs and the CEO this morning, we're talking with Adrian Davis, the CEO for My Ideal Doctor from Atlanta, Georgia. And Adrian, we've been talking about everything from affordable care to the market for telemedicine and telehealth. Where do you see the savings and convenience that telehealth does offer?
You're going to see it in lower cost. Take us, for example, a typical primary care visit that we can handle could be anywhere from $70 to $120, whereas we're $45 and below. We're easy access. You don't have to wait and sit in a crowded waiting room with other sick people. You don't have to take 4 hours out of your job and go and try to get an appointment. We're 24/7. And so just when you look at productivity, it's huge. The average time away for a physician appointment is 4 hours. In today's world, it's hard for an average American to take that time off. If they've got a family, obviously that kind of increases what they need to do because the kids have to go and see the physician as well. The savings and the access are really amazing in the telehealth world. Just transportation. If you're looking at a population that's in rural areas, gas prices, waiting, transporting to that physician, you're really looking at a lot of costs built into the system that can be avoided through telehealth. And that's just what we do. When you look at readmissions, the costs are enormous having someone readmitted because say they have congestive heart failure, they go home and just say their Lasix aren't working very well or they're not taking them. You really do not know there's an episode creeping up, finally creeps up, and they have to go back to the hospital. Whereas right now we can send them out with a weight scale. We can remotely monitor that weight scale. They need to weigh themselves every 12 hours. If we notice a gain of weight within a 12-hour period, say they gain 8 pounds, boom, we know they're retaining water and something's not working. The Lasix aren't working and so forth. So immediately we get on the phone with them or a video call with the physician, see what's going on, see how we need to handle it and prevent that person to getting readmitted and causing thousands of more unnecessary dollars in our healthcare system. No matter how you look at it, the cost savings are there. I mean, when you look at just say an ICU unit, rural hospitals can't necessarily staff a full-time stroke specialist. But with the advances of telehealth, now they have the ability to zoom in to a specialist in a hospital hundreds of miles away and be able to treat that patient right then and there with the type of care they need. No matter what segment you look at through telehealth, the savings are there, the convenience factor is there, and it's really going to drive the future of medicine.
Where do you see the different growth areas? There's so many things that you can say. Telehealth is very, very similar to in-person healthcare. There's mm-hmm. very few differences of things that you couldn't do with telemedicine.
I think the big growth areas are going to be primary care and what we do currently today. I think mental health is going to be a great, huge growth area. I think your specialty telemedicine companies have a lot of growth that they're going to be able to see. I think remote monitoring. When you look at our baby boomers, I believe it was 2 years ago, Dick, where 10,000 a day, every day, were turning 65 for the next 19 years. You're talking about a huge part of the population that is going to need to get monitored remotely. That, once you hit that 60, 65 range, you're unfortunately going to probably be susceptible to a chronic disease, whether it's high blood pressure, whether it's diabetes. And so those patients are going to need to be monitored. I think you're going to see really big growth in that area, essentially aging at home. And being able to, whether it's their blood pressure, whether it's their diabetes, whatnot, really being able to be monitored. If there's a spike in one of them, that information sent over to a nurse team. If it's something serious, it could be sent over to a physician. We actually have a joint venture with another company called OneCare, and we can do that currently. You can go into the system. Essentially, you have a care team around you in that system. If you're a diabetic and you're supposed to test 3 times a day, if you don't test at your 8 a.m., boom, the system knows it, sends out an alert to you saying, hey, Dick, please go and test. When you do test and you're high or low, the system can send out an alert to your care team to let them know and to see if there's something that, we can be proactive. The whole point of telehealth is being proactive versus we've always been reactive in our healthcare industry. And so we can be proactive with family members and nurses and doctors and really try to nail down what's wrong right then and there versus waiting and really causing unnecessary dollars in the healthcare system to be spent when they shouldn't be. I see it globally. I see it in countries that are not necessarily they're third world countries and they desperately need access to healthcare. I see the growth really in those areas. I think it's an exciting time. There's a lot of fantastic companies in the marketplace doing a lot of fantastic things. So it's going to be very good, I think, for healthcare in the future because of blending technology.
That's a very good explanation of what we see as the growth of telemedicine or telehealth. How about the technological advantages? What are some of the things that you're seeing that maybe are not exactly out on the market yet, but are coming very shortly?
Well, I think just with the help, you know, when you read in the papers and, you know, you hear a lot about Facebook and Google trying to provide internet access to parts of the world that just do not have it, or, you know, do not have stable connectivity. Doing big jobs like that really trickles down to every industry and helps everyone, because once they can provide that internet access, boom, now those populations have access to whether it's financial industries or healthcare. There's other companies that aren't necessarily healthcare companies that are making a big impact and are going to make a big impact. So I think technological advances such as just providing internet access, faster bandwidth, and remote monitoring, being able to connect. Apple came out with what's called the Help Kit. So essentially, right now, if you've got a Jawbone or you got a Fitbit or you got a Nike armband, and you happen to lose or break that item, and you want to switch from, say, Fitbit to Nike, well, essentially, you lose all your information because it's stored on Fitbit. And now with a product like OneCare or a product like Apple's Help Kit, now all that information can be stored in one repository. We're going to be able to pull from that information. They're opening it up to developers to connect to their APIs, so we can pull that information. So when our physician's on the call with Dick, and Dick's, say, a diabetic, and we're looking at what's the trend over the last 6 months, our doctors can see that. And so I think it's just going to be phenomenal all around. A lot of companies getting into the space. And at the end of the day, everyone's in it for the right reason. They really just want to make this world better.
Adrian, this has been terrific having you on the program on Top Docs and the CEO this morning from Atlanta, Georgia. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Dick, thank you so much, and I hope you have a great Saturday.
And you. Well, there's so many new things and new ideas, and yet it seems to be so complicated today in looking at healthcare, medical attention, things of that sort. But what we try to do on Top Docs and the CEO is to get everybody to look at some of these new ideas. And we had a couple of new ideas this week. Certainly, Adrian Davis, CEO of My Ideal Doctor, checked in with us from Atlanta. And the editor-in-chief, Michael Tetro, from Concierge Medicine Today. And, of course, we had Dr. Stan Snowden, our expert on new medicines hitting the market. And, of course, Terry Belanger, CEO of TechNet. So next week, we're going to have Dr. Avinash Akrikar. He's Net Medical's chief cardiologist, who will be talking about problems with the heart. How do you stay healthy and afford some of the, how do you avoid some of the problems with the heart? And how do you know that you're starting to suffer from a heart attack? Those are all things that we need to look at. All this and more on Top Docs and the CEO. This is Dick Kabatsky, CEO of Net Medical. Have a great week, everybody.